KaiserNetwork.org.
Good morning. Oh, that was really terrible. I know we're all tired, but let's try that again. Good morning.
Good morning.
That's it. That's it. We're on the move. This has been a different kind of conference, and I don't know about you, but I feel very energized, and I feel like we're on the move. Thank you. It's a new day in prevention. This is our closing session, I think one that really will help you, and I hope help all of us bring it all together, since we've talked about synergy. And this is synergy between science and program. Our first speaker will be speaking about incarcerated populations, prevention, and community linkages. And that will be given by Dr. Timothy Flanagan. Dr. Flanagan is a professor of medicine at Brown Medical School and director of the Division of Infectious Diseases. He joined Brown University in 1991 to work with Dr. Charles Carpenter. He has spearheaded an HIV primary care initiative to outreach among HIV-positive women, substance abusers, and prisoners. And something that's not on Tim's bio, but will also help you know how old I am, is I was Tim's internal medicine fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, Tim Flanagan.
Thank you, Vicki. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to talk. But most of all, I want to thank them for focusing on this very important topic. Now, I am an AIDS conference veteran for the last 20 years, but I have to tell you, I enjoy this conference the most because it's real people doing real work in the trenches, struggling day in and day out with HIV prevention and treatment, often with limited resources. So I take my hats off to you. I also have to say that when I went through the lobby last night around 12:30, everyone was having a very good time. So maybe those two things go together. Okay. So, many people think of corrections as being a jail and a prison behind a huge concrete wall which is out there. People that are incarcerated are not part of our community. We know that that is absolutely wrong. Those concrete walls are really more a semi-permeable membrane. As you can see from this slide, in the United States, there are over 10 million inmates per year that are released to the community. So that individuals in jail and prison are going back and forth and back and forth, and these different colored dots here represent the many infectious diseases, such as HIV, hepatitis B and C, STDs, that are therefore both within the correctional setting and within the community. So corrections is part of our community. If we are committed to prevention and care, we must be involved within the correctional setting, and the data that I will talk about, I think, will support that. Now, this slide is from work by Ted Hammett going back to 1997, and what it shows is the percent of individuals with different infectious diseases that pass through the correctional setting in that year. It's not the percentage that are in corrections, but they go through, because corrections is really a revolving door. And he estimated that among individuals with AIDS, it was 16%. With individuals with HIV, it was 20 to 26%. Chronic hepatitis B, over 12%. Hepatitis C, about a third. And active TB disease, 38%. So the burden of infectious diseases within the correctional setting is enormous. Now, this disproportionate burden of HIV, along with incarceration and with substance abuse, is disproportionately borne by the minority community, and particularly by the African-American community. African-American men bear the highest burden of incarceration and HIV. They have six times the HIV rates of white men and over 10 times the incarceration rates of white men. But incarceration can provide a public health opportunity to intervene. This slide is from the CDC data showing the increase in the proportion of AIDS cases among black individuals, and you can see, as you all know, this rate approaching 50%. So this epidemic of HIV, incarceration, and substance use is enormous and is very heavily borne in the African-American community and really requires and mandates a very focused and an effective response. So I'm going to speak a little bit today about opportunities for HIV testing, prevention, and linkage to care in the correctional setting. Now, when I say correctional setting, I'm going to talk about prisons and jails. And just a little primer. Prisons is where you go when you have been sentenced for a crime. Most individuals in prison are there for a longer period of time, over a year. Jails are where you go when you're picked up. They tend to be chaotic places, it's very transient, and you're usually there just when you're charged. And I'll point out some of the differences as we go along. Now, one of the big successes, which is extraordinary, which we need to celebrate, is that the AIDS-related mortality has fallen dramatically in state prison facilities. So AIDS-related deaths overall in state prisons has dropped by more than 80% since 1995 due to HART. In 1999, the AIDS-related death rate was 20 per 100,000 in state prisoners, which was actually lower than it is for comparable groups with AIDS in the general population. And routine HIV testing is offered in many systems, about 19 states now, and the community standard for treatment is accepted as the appropriate standard in corrections. This is very important. It means we still have a long way to go within the prison system, but the standard is out there, and our goal and the goal of public health and corrections working together is to try and achieve that. This slide just shows the relative HIV seropositivity rates among prison inmates from 1999 to 2005. The good news is that these rates have fallen. They've fallen slightly, but this is very significant. If you look at the top line, which is among women, the rate's fallen from 3% to under 2.5%. And although the drop in the HIV seropositivity rates in men is relatively smaller, it's been consistent and is very significant. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about Rhode Island, and I'll go back and forth and talk about Rhode Island as well as other systems. This is our maximum security prison, which is in Cranston, and myself and one of my colleagues. We've been very lucky because we have one centralized system, both a jail and a prison. Back in 1989, routine HIV testing was initiated. In the first 10 years of the epidemic, 26 to 32% of all the HIV positive tests in the state came from the correctional setting. It was by far and away the most important testing site. And then due to leadership, particularly by Dr. Carpenter and the state level and the correctional level, a committed HIV care program was instituted, which included care within the state and within the community. And that linkage has proven to be enormously effective. But that's taken place in one system. I've told you we've made progress in prisons. But the new frontier, and the one where I think we have to focus as we move forward, is HIV prevention and care within the jails. There are 16 times the number of individuals that pass through jails than prison. But jails are really tough to work in. They're chaotic. They're in county and city jurisdictions. They're not centralized. It's hard to find the leadership. Often they operate with very poor funding. Inmates are transient. The median length of stay in most jails is less than 3 days. Security is the priority in jails, not public health and not health care. So it's hard to work there, but as I'm going to show you, I think we have to work there. There is no choice. Now, one of the things that has made this possible is rapid testing. And this is obviously a slide of Oraquick. There's also Unigold. But rapid testing programs has been shown to be very effective within jails. And I'm going to show you data that's been presented at this conference. One of the reasons why I'm so passionate about it is that even though we've been able to do comprehensive testing in Rhode Island and in other prison systems, the standard is often, quote, no news is good news. Now, this is going to be shocking to some of you, not to those that work in corrections, but to others. In Rhode Island, when you go through, you get your blood drawn. You're told it's for an HIV test. But in essence, there's no counseling the way we think of counseling. A consent is signed. But if you don't hear back, the assumption is your test is negative. And when we looked at Project START, unfortunately, in most other systems with routine testing, the same thing. No news is good news. This is a huge challenge. We're missing the opportunity for effective HIV prevention in one of our most vulnerable communities. One of the reasons why rapid testing is so attractive is when you're sitting there doing and developing your rapid test, it's a great opportunity to do counseling. So my hope is that when we institute rapid testing, we'll be instituting clients that are counseling at the same time. So this is data from the Rapid HIV Test in Jail project funded by the CDC, four states in 25 jails, 2004 to 2006. 33,000 tests done, 1.3% were positive, and 269 individuals were newly identified with HIV. About half of these diagnoses were among persons with heterosexual or no reported risk. And this is so common in corrections that individuals with heterosexual risk do not perceive themselves to be at risk for HIV. The best news is that as a result of this study, rapid testing programs have been mainstreamed and actually expanded in Florida and New York and Louisiana and are continuing in Wisconsin. Now, data presented at this conference here, and I'm really excited about all the correction work presented at this conference, is from a very ambitious, effective HIV rapid testing program in the D.C. jail system. The D.C. jail has 18,000 intakes per year. 88% are male, 89% black. HIV testing was done using OraQuick, and HIV testing was, quote, automatic. That was a new term for me. And that meant it was done unless an inmate refused. And when the question was asked, 8% of inmates did refuse. So I think that's good and appropriate. But it's an opt-out strategy. 11,000 tests were performed, and when they analyzed the data, African-American men were significantly more likely to be tested in jail than in any other sites. That's any other sites throughout the city. 240 persons were identified to be HIV positive. Half of them were newly diagnosed, and all were referred to care. We tend to look at this data and assess how many are newly diagnosed. But remember, a lot of the individuals in jail, they may know they're positive, but they're out of care. They may not admit it. And a repeat routine testing program can help link them back to care. So there's a big value of testing somebody who already knew they were positive because it can serve as a linkage to care. But there's also some not so good news. This is a paper recently from CID, and it showed the immune status, meaning the CD4 count of presentation to care, has not improved among antiretroviral naive persons from 1990 to 2006 at the Johns Hopkins HIV Clinic, which is spectacular, in Baltimore, Maryland. Baltimore is one of the top 10-5 cities in terms of HIV and AIDS rates. We would think with all of this work going on, with all this testing, we'd be diagnosing people earlier and getting them to care, but we're not. The median presenting CD4 count was 371 back in 1990 to 94. It dropped to 276. And multivariate analysis has shown that male sex, being a man, and being African-American, meant you presented with lower CD4 counts. Now, what's going on? What the at-risk community, particularly if you're a man or you're African-American, is just not being tested early in the disease, only later when CD4 counts have fallen. Part of the problem is, with all of the spectacular CDC and other initiatives on HIV testing and medical care, let's face it, the medical system focuses on women early on. It does not focus on men. So young men don't have routine primary care. Particularly, you're going to have less access if you're poor or if you're African American. So men are not going to be reached necessarily through a lot of those initiatives. So we have to reach out, and jail is one of those places. And this slide is a little dramatic, but still, sometimes we're smoking while the house is on fire, and the result is bad. So why is there not routine mainstream HIV testing? And what about syphilis testing? What about gonorrhea and chlamydia testing in the Baltimore jail system? This is an example not to pick on Baltimore. Okay, HRSA has funded a special project of national significance. There are going to be 10 sites with 16 jails that's going to look at rapid testing and linkage to care, and hopefully this will make a difference. Now, I want to talk a little bit about prevention. This is data from a study in Rhode Island where we did rapid testing and risk assessment on 100 folks, and three-quarters of the folks did not consider themselves to be at risk. So you can't just test people that think they're at risk. You've got to test everyone. Multiple sexual partners was common. Condom use was rare. self-reported STDs were common. When we asked folks, most people thought that testing within the Rhode Island Department of Corrections was a good idea, and most thought that partner notification would be helpful. But we're not doing it, and that's another area we need to look at. Now, this slide is small, but it shows the gonorrhea rates broken down by race. And you can see the incredible burden of gonorrhea in the African-American community. Well, I've just talked about HIV testing. What about STD testing? And this slide shows a very important study on a urine-based jail screening program for gonorrhea and chlamydia in New York. In the first year in six jails, you can see the number of men reporting with chlamydia increased by over 1,600%. So, and by this, by far and away surpassed all the other testing sites. So the adult jail became the most important STD testing site. So is there routine STD testing for GC and chlamydia in Jackson, Mississippi, in Miami, in Atlanta? Look at the southeast where GC and chlamydia is exploding. What are we doing? And this is part of HIV prevention. Prevention within corrections is possible. The CDC-funded Project START, which we're very happy to learn is going to be a Debbie, and it looked at 522 young men being released from prison. It compared a single-session client-centered approach to a six-session intervention, two within corrections and four after, one-on-one, client-centered. And what it showed is that 6 weeks after release, those individuals with a sixth session had a significant reduction in unprotected vaginal and anal sex. And the difference is relatively small, but very powerful. Okay, now what about sex within jails or prison? It does occur. This is an MMWR talking about a HIV transmission which occurred in Georgia among 88 inmates. And a smaller study showed that where consensual sex is going on, people are often trying to get protection. Ongoing risk-taking behaviors occurs in jail and prison, but much less than in the community. As my friend Barry Zach said, most of the HIV-positive people going into jail and prison and leaving jail and prison came in infected. So most of transmission is occurring in the community, not within the setting behind the walls. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be developing effective prevention behind the walls. We should, obviously. Now, last point. What happens after release? Linkage to care is critical, it's possible, and it can be successful. It's usually done with case management paired with community outreach. And the key component is starting prior to release. So an excellent model is Hampden County, Mass., where they've linked the correctional setting with the community. They've done it by looking at four health centers, which they assign people based on zip code or by their history. They have dually based team members. This is a really important principle. Individuals that are comfortable working both within the health center and within the corrections. This actually helps to transform the correctional setting. It also helps to transform the healthcare setting. So this dually based concept, if it's achievable, a lot of times it's hard because of geography, really can work well. So the HIV patient show rate after release was 84% to 90%, really extraordinary. And there was a decrease in emergency room visits and hospitalizations before versus after jail. So it was very, very cost effective. Project Bridge is a similar project in Rhode Island. This is what South Providence looks like. It's not as bad as some of the other inner cities around. And we use a drop-in center and a two-person team with a social worker and a outreach worker, which has been very, very effective. Initially, there's daily contact, then weekly contact, then monthly contact. 95% of eligible folks have enrolled. 90% have a clinic visit in the first month, but many miss an appointment. You've got to be flexible. You can't be rigid. It's been associated with increases in CD4 count, decreases in viral load, and good continuity. But most of our clients continue to use drugs. So we thought, gosh, maybe this will mean, will folks be abstinent? No. Ongoing substance use is the rule, not the exception. Now, just a few thoughts to try and encourage you or help you if you're thinking about working in the jail or the prison, or you do work there. First is, unexpected things happen. And you've got to be very flexible. So get ready. The second thing is, scaling those prison and jail walls in order to get inside can often be discouraging. So you may feel like this poor fellow on this big tall wall. Remember, your priority, which is health and public health, is not the priority of the correctional system. For them, it's security. So you've got to be patient. You've got to be flexible. But why are you doing it? You're doing it because the inmates really need your help. And it can be very satisfying, and it can be very, very rewarding and very interesting. Partnership is absolutely key. And this is partnership with professionals and with the community. With professionals, I mean partnering with wardens where you can, with correctional officers, with administrators that don't share your point of view. This is hard to do sometimes because we're obviously passionate and strongly believe in what we do, but it's the key to success within corrections. You've got to understand where they're coming from, which is not public health, but security. So I also say partnering with the community, and you probably think I mean with a really good CBO, and I definitely mean that. You've got to be working with your CBO, but it also means working with the community, which is the inmates. And the poster here on the side is from an inmate who drew this poster as part of a behind-the-walls prevention project. And the point being, you've got to be working with that community, which is the key community as well. So a lot of people to thank, including the CDC, NIH, our Center for AIDS Research. I also list a number of people who I work with here at Brown. And at the bottom, I want to thank colleagues around the country who have been deeply involved in correctional HIV work, many for over 10 years. And this is my backup team, keeps me sane. And this last slide is from a jail in Mysore in southern India. I've only talked about HIV within corrections in the United States, but this is a much bigger global problem which also needs our care and attention and passion. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Tim. Our next presenter is going to be Alice Gandelman, and she is going to speak about science to program translation for community-based organization. She is the director of the California STD-HIV Prevention Training Center and chief of the disease prevention section of the STD Control Branch for California Department of Public Health. She has received her MPH in community health education from San Jose State and has worked in HIV, STD, and hepatitis programs for over 20 years in both community and public health settings. She oversees training and technical assistance activities for clinical, behavioral intervention, and partner service programs for California, as well as many HIV training and prevention projects. I think the most important thing to me that Alice has mentioned is how she is committed, and I think you'll see when you listen to her, to integrating community, provider, funder, and research agendas to improve the quality of life services delivered in practice settings. Alice?
Thank you, Vicki. I'm very happy to be here, and thanks for inviting me to speak about these important topics. When I was asked to speak about science to program translation for community-based organizations, I realized that if I was to genuinely speak about this topic, I really needed to address it from additional perspectives. So I decided to change the title just slightly to reflect the broader perspective and would like to talk about science to program and program to science translation for community-based organizations, health departments, researchers, and funders, what we all need to know, because we're all involved in this effort together and we must work very closely in research translation activities if we want to have success. So during my discussion, I'll be speaking from a program or practice perspective. There we go. I was asked to speak about five general areas: the importance of translation of research into practice, challenges of translating research into programs and practice settings, examples of successful translations, lessons learned to date, and recommendations to expedite the process. So a lot to talk about in 20 minutes. I'd like to begin by addressing research and evidence-based approaches. Evidence-based interventions are those that have been tested using methodologically rigorous designs and evaluated using behavioral or health outcomes by utilizing comparison or control groups. Research studies determine whether an intervention is efficacious. In other words, does it work? And are the effects due to the intervention and not something else? Understandably, efficacy is a central focus, and the early stages of research translation focus primarily on how to transfer efficacious or evidence-based studies to community or program settings. Technology transfer was a very popular term, which was widely used and still is today, although to a lesser extent, as a way to disseminate evidence-based interventions into programs. Although technology transfer was the popular approach used for many years, during the early phases of the diffusion process, the term has had implications for community-based organizations and other HIV prevention providers. Technology transfer is viewed by many programs as a one-way street from funders and researchers down to programs. And while the science or research view was emphasized and was the basis of the technology transfer, it did not include other factors or viewpoints necessary for successful translation. The term technology exchange has been used more recently to describe the multidirectional technology and information exchange that incorporates the experiences and expertise of valued partners with often years of experience working in HIV prevention in their respective communities. It's not to say that technology transfer is wrong and technology exchange is right. It's just that each has a different emphasis, and we need both. We need to be focused on efficacy issues and how science-based programs get disseminated because we want to deliver efficacious programs. But we also need to emphasize technology exchange because this, too, is critical for DEBI diffusion. Technology exchange, in fact, is critical for effectiveness research and research translation. While efficacy is concerned with whether an intervention does more good than harm when delivered under controlled circumstances, effectiveness research has been defined as whether a program does more good than harm when delivered under real-world conditions. Effectiveness research looks at implementation in practice settings and identifies what factors act as benefits or barriers to successful implementation. I'll talk about some of these factors in just a few minutes. The reality is, most of our previous efforts have been focused on technology transfer, and we are only more recently understanding the importance of technology exchange and its role in effectiveness research. The Diffusion of Effective Behavioral Interventions, or DEBI program, that we're also familiar with, has furthered our understanding of how complex the application of research into practice or real-world settings can be, and the importance of partner dialogue. Given these complexities, I'd now like to describe some of the challenges of translating research into practice. One challenge that is often overlooked is the sheer number of partners that are involved in the research translation and DEBI diffusion process. In addition to persons living with and those at increased risk for HIV and affected community, other partners include funders, researchers, community and faith-based organizations, state and local health departments, which may also include one or more of the above entities, our CDC partners, including center, division, and branch representatives from multiple programs, national, state, and local training and technical assistance partners, and there are probably some that I've forgotten that belong on this list. The point is, with so many people involved in the diffusion process, communication is extremely important, including who we communicate with, what gets communicated, how that communication occurs, and when certain things get communicated. Research translation and the current national diffusion efforts via DEBI is a relatively new and evolving process, and as a result, updates, revisions, and changes occur frequently. So who hears what from who and when they hear it is important in this evolving field, particularly as it relates to definitions, program requirements, and how DEBIs can and cannot be implemented, which brings me to the next slide. The accurate or correct implementation of DEBIs has been another challenge many CBOs and other funded agencies have experienced, particularly as it relates to fidelity, or adhering to core elements based on the internal logic of a particular intervention. By way of implementation in a real world or practice setting, we know that some level of adaptation is bound to occur. While adaptation continues to be better articulated and defined as we progress, it is at the same time becoming less clear-cut as we travel further down the Debbie diffusion road. We are fairly clear about what constitutes fidelity and fairly clear about what constitutes reinvention. But at what point on the line does adaptation become reinvention? Does adding a session addressing different behavioral determinants for the same target population equal reinvention? Does taking a session away constitute reinvention if it does not alter intervention outcomes? I think we still have much to learn regarding where the boundary lines are for adaptation, and we'll hopefully be learning that in the next several years. And finally, determining the extent to which Debbie implementation has been successful, whether adaptation has occurred or not, is also challenging, as there are currently not sufficient resources for agencies to conduct meaningful evaluation. I'll speak more about this in a bit. Another important we are learning is that effective research translation requires sufficient workforce capacity. Although some CBOs and health departments are highly skilled, others are inadequately prepared. Successful Debbie implementation requires prerequisite foundational skills that are not usually covered in Debbie-specific trainings. These skills are critical and have become more apparent throughout the Debbie diffusion process. Foundation skills have not historically been an issue during intervention studies because research staff tend to be fully trained according to intervention protocols to ensure fidelity throughout the study. In general, the greater the intervention complexity, the greater the capacity needed to implement with fidelity, which is an important consideration in the Debbie selection process. Basic foundation skills are necessary for the successful implementation of individual, group, or community-level Debbies. And without going into great detail, at a minimum, providers should either be representative of or have a thorough understanding of the communities they are serving. If conducting a Debbie that's an individual-level intervention, they should be competent in client-centered counseling, including risk assessment and risk reduction counseling. For group-level interventions, group process and facilitation skills, including conflict management. And for community-level interventions, street outreach skills such as ethnography and field safety. What we are learning is that we cannot simply choose a Debbie or an intervention without simultaneously considering the risk behaviors and characteristics of the population prioritized for services, the intervention requirements and feasibility of conducting that intervention in a given community, and the capacity of staff in a given agency to effectively carry it out. All of these factors must be looked at together because each is an important piece that will affect implementation and outcomes. Despite the challenges, there have also been many successful translations or creative approaches used to implement evidence-based interventions in the field, and I'd like to highlight what a few agencies have done in this regard to best meet their needs. Many currently available Debbies are not good matches for smaller states with low HIV morbidity. This was the case for the Idaho State Health Department, so they decided to integrate RESPECT into their statewide counseling, testing, and referral strategy. For them, the majority of prevention opportunities occur when clients interact with providers during individual counseling and clinic appointments. As a result, all state and local prevention providers now receive a day of basic HIV prevention counseling, followed by the two-day RESPECT training. Although this is not really an adaptation, by combining these two approaches, Idaho was able to utilize an evidence-based intervention in their counseling and testing programs to best meet their needs. CenterForce is an organization that provides services for prisoners and family members and adapted healthy relationships for incarcerated men and women in two different prisons in the Bay Area and Central California. The intervention sessions did not vary significantly, but as we heard from our last speaker, implementation planning became a major focus for the agency as they had to obtain buy-in and approval throughout the prison system and leadership at each of the institutions, which required several months of advanced planning. Recruitment strategies also had to be altered within these closed systems to maintain and protect client confidentiality. The Broadway Youth Center at Howard Brown Health Center in Chicago adapted or reinvented Sista for transgender communities and renamed it Twista. This involved changing the intervention sessions to more closely relate to issues that are central for transgender communities, particularly around cultural and gender pride. They have also added an additional session to focus on transgender-specific roles related to risk-taking behaviors for them and their sexual partners, as well as safer needle use for hormone and other injections. Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York has enhanced their implementation of Community Promise by using the Internet as a way of recruiting for the intervention and displaying some role model stories to motivate potential program participants. In order to market the program to the House and Ball community with community input, they rebranded Community Promise as For Real, Role Models Educating All Labels. Members of the House and Ball community often use the Internet to stay connected, network, socialize, and plan future events. In addition to maintaining fidelity of the Community Promise intervention, they added an innovative approach to reach youth by creating a webpage on MySpace where role model stories and other prevention materials are provided. The webpage was an effective way to expose youth to the role model stories. Youth have the opportunity to comment and exchange views about the stories, and by keeping track of the frequency of site visits, staff can gauge the popularity of the webpage. I'd now like to offer several recommendations to continue moving translation efforts forward. And the first one is to increase emphasis on workforce capacity by offering courses such as introductory behavioral science, prevention counseling, group facilitation, ethnography, and field safety, and perhaps recruitment and retention trainings. Equally important are the basic program planning courses such as community assessment, objective writing, logic models, and program evaluation. Many community-based organization and health department staff have invaluable skills and expertise within their community settings, but they may not have backgrounds in the above areas. Having a stronger foundation in these areas will go a long way to increase capacity for successful implementation, whether it is a DEBI, a best practice, or a homegrown intervention, because all of these courses build critical thinking skills, which greatly contribute to building excellent programs. Which brings me to my next recommendation. Perhaps it's time to consider HIV prevention specialist certification programs. These programs are not uncommon and have been used for other professions as well, such as for disease intervention specialists. The Institute for HIV Prevention Leadership is one good example of such a program for HIV prevention staff for CBOs, and I understand that there's consideration for a similar program for health department staff. The National Coalition of STD Directors is also considering a leadership program for STD program managers. While these are excellent programs, the number of persons who could ultimately benefit far outweigh the actual number who are able to take advantage of these opportunities. Larger programs, should they be developed, would require significant resources, prioritization of desired skills, and program outcomes. I believe that with current national HIV diffusion efforts via DEBIs, we are at the perfect time to put more emphasis on effectiveness studies or programs that focus on outcomes of evidence-based interventions conducted in practice as opposed to research settings and utilize participatory research approaches that actively involve clients, affected communities, researchers, funders, providers, and technical assistance partners, because all of these people, i.e., all of us, are involved in the diffusion process. Some of these things are already happening, which is good, but not enough of them. There are some effectiveness frameworks that may be relevant for us, one of which is called REAIM by Russell Glasgow and colleagues. Glasgow's REAIM model is a framework that examines issues relevant to program adoption, implementation, and sustainability, and attempts to close gaps between research and practice by looking at reach, efficacy, effectiveness, adoption, implementation, and maintenance. There's so much to say about this model, but due to time constraints, I'd like to refer interested folks to his website, where he discusses the framework in greater detail, as well as additional applications for it in effectiveness studies. And it's on the screen here, www.reaim.org. If we are not yet at the point where we can conduct more effectiveness studies, in the interim, we should place more emphasis on evaluation as DEBI implementation evolves. Many of us are familiar with process monitoring, but less of us regularly conduct process evaluation, which tells us if the intervention has been conducted as intended. And both outcome monitoring and evaluation are becoming increasingly important as adaptations continue to occur. Too often, we see evaluation as punitive, and agencies have certainly been given messages that DEBIs must be implemented with fidelity. But there are probably good reasons why they aren't, and it would benefit us to know what those barriers are in practice settings. My last recommendation is really a question, and that is, do we need a translation model to support agencies to effectively implement evidence-based approaches? We have efficacy models via DEBIs, and there are some effectiveness models such as REAIM that may prove to be beneficial in measuring what happens in the field after interventions are rolled out. Perhaps we need a translational model that guides agencies to support both efficacy and effectiveness. There are actually a few research translation resources that are now available. The Behavioral Intervention Training Centers, part of the National Network of Prevention Training Centers, have developed and standardized a national course called Selecting Evidence-Based Interventions, which is available for health departments and CBOs and other agencies implementing EBIs. This course is based on a model developed by the ADAPT and Science Application teams and other partners at the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention and is relevant for agencies who are making decisions about which EBI to choose, as well as those who have chosen an intervention and are seeking guidance on how to adapt. Information about this course is available through the NNPTC website. In closing, I'd like to end with a few messages for CBOs, researchers, and funders. And I'm not leaving health departments out because you know you may be represented in one, if not all, of the above categories. So these messages are for you, too. If you are a CBO representative, engage in a healthy dialogue with your research colleagues and funders. I know it can sometimes be a precarious relationship, but if you know something won't work, say so, but don't stop there. Say why it doesn't work, but don't stop there. Say what you think will work better. Because funders and researchers do want to know these things, and you may be your community's best representative. Many of you are already doing this. If you are a researcher, to the extent possible, think from an effectiveness perspective while being mindful of efficacy issues, because we realize that this is important in your priority. Imagine a much less controlled setting where your intervention will be conducted and consider the degree to which it can be developed within a flexible framework regarding core elements and other components. Talk to a CBO or health department employee and get their perspective on study design, methodology, feasibility, and logistics of your intervention in their setting, as well as staff training and other capacity needs from a practice-based perspective. Again, many of you may already be doing this, but the more the better. And if you are a funder, to the extent possible, invest in capacity building from a foundational perspective. What are the basic capacity needs required of HIV prevention providers to successfully implement evidence-based interventions? What other challenges do you anticipate agencies will experience, and how can you address and support them in these barriers? How can training and technical assistance be better coordinated to improve workforce capacity in HIV prevention? And I know many of these activities may already be occurring, which is a good thing, but more needs to happen. We are all committed to the same goal, but tend to see things from our own perspective. Research translation requires all partners to see things from multiple perspectives. I believe we're moving in that direction, but if we all do just a little bit more of this, I think we can truly make a difference in the epidemic. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Alice. I think you gave us a great deal to think about in a very cogent talk, articulating, I think, what many of us have talked about in the corridors and since we've come to this meeting and even before. Our next speaker is going to be Dr. Jeffrey Kelly. He's going to speak to us about technology transfer and new ways to disseminate information. Dr. Kelly is professor and senior vice chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He directs the Center for AIDS Intervention Research, known as CARE, a research center funded since 1994 by the National Institute of Mental Health. Dr. Kelly is an author of over 300 publications exclusively in the HIV/AIDS field since the mid-1980s, and his research is focused on the conceptualization, conduct, and rigorous evaluation of HIV primary and secondary prevention interventions, both in the United States and in other areas of the world. Much of his current work has addressed the problem of HIV/AIDS in countries of the former Soviet Union. And something that Jeff hasn't put on his bio that each of you should know here, and I've told Jeff I will say this until the day I die, he took a wet behind the ears African-American minority junior investigator who could not find a mentor and took her under his wing and mentored her so that that person can stand before you today. I bring you Jeff Kelly.
Thank you so much, Vicki. A few years ago, I was at a conference, it might have been this one, and I was presenting outcomes of an HIV prevention intervention that we had recently done, and it was positive, the results were good. And after the presentation, someone came up to me and said, "Isn't it great that your research stops HIV, stops people from contracting HIV?" And not being one to dodge a compliment, I said, "Thank you." But then I realized later, it's not true. It's not true. Research and HIV prevention approaches can only contribute to the public health goal of stopping the disease when interventions are translated and transferred to providers, when they can be used by providers, when they're adapted to meet local needs, when they're owned by provider agencies, and when they produce positive outcomes in the community. This morning, I'm going to be using the words "we" pretty often. And when I say "we" or "our," I'm referring to my colleagues at the Center for AIDS Intervention Research CARE, and also my colleagues at community-based organizations in the country, in the world, with whom we've collaborated in this work. Research undertaken over the past 20 years has convincingly demonstrated that many interventions can reduce sexual risk behaviors in many vulnerable populations. Individual-level interventions, couples counseling, small group programs, social network interventions, community-level interventions, and structural change approaches. Although these different interventions have been cast from differing theoretical frameworks, and they've often been given different names, different brands or identities, effective interventions share much more in common with one another than they have differences. Always we find attention to a core set of psychosocial behavior change constructs, including correct risk understanding, positive attitudes, beliefs, motivations, and intentions towards behavior change, and also the practice of cognitive and behavioral skills needed to bring about change. Effective interventions, regardless of their theory, regardless of their name, always involve attention to helping people handle real-life personal situations that might otherwise trigger risk behavior. If the interventions are meant to promote maintenance of change, and hopefully they are, then development of normative and social and partner supports. Effective interventions, no matter what their theory, no matter what their brand, are delivered by charismatic agents that believe in them and that understand client and community culture, relationships, and circumstances, and there's enough of an intervention to make a difference. The traditional products of HIV prevention research are articles that appear primarily in scientific journals read by other scientists. However, the most important users, the most important audience of HIV prevention research are public health service providers nationally and internationally. Service providers often lack access to the journals in which HIV prevention research is published, or in the international arena, don't speak the language that the journals are published in. Providers couldn't possibly be successful in implementing an intervention from what's usually present in a journal article, you know, about that much space describing the program and pages describing the statistical methods. Providers have to guess how to tailor interventions to meet their needs while maintaining attention to critical core elements. Although researchers have extensively studied the effects of HIV prevention interventions, there's been very little study of how best to move evidence-based models from the research arena to service providers. Most investigators want to see their interventions used, and most make manuals or outlines available. CDC has led in efforts to identify efficacious models and offer training to providers in them through the replication projects, DEBI, and other mechanisms. However, the field has lacked systematic comparative research on how best to translate evidence-based interventions to providers on a wide scale and how to assist providers in using those interventions. In our experience, providers understand community needs, want to know about program-relevant research, but also want to tailor and adapt evidence-based interventions to meet local needs. Service provider agencies understand much better than researchers key issues, needs, priorities, and perspectives of the communities they serve and the constituencies they represent. Experienced provider agencies are not passively sitting around waiting for researchers and funders to tell them what to do, as much as researchers and funders would hope otherwise. Evidence-based models have to be tailored to meet the needs of the provider agency and the community while maintaining critical core elements responsible for the intervention's impact. Bridging the gap between the science and the service of HIV prevention is by no means a unique question in the HIV prevention arena. There's been a large literature on the effects of continuing medical education, CME, and it illustrates the challenges faced in technology exchange efforts. CME research conducted for 30 years has shown that information or one-shot training in a new medical procedure, the new way to do tonsillectomies, for example, can increase provider knowledge but does not necessarily influence provider practices. New adoption of programs by providers is greatest when providers are themselves dissatisfied with currently available techniques, perceive a new approach as more effective than existing methods, when providers are high in openness to innovation and have enough resources and money for new program adoption, when providers receive adequate training, practice-based training in the new model, when high-status peers are known to have already adopted the innovation and been successful with it, when access is provided to ongoing implementation assistance and problem-solving, and when providers can reinvent a model and can feel true ownership of it. CARE investigators began a line of studies to scientifically study approaches for transferring evidence-based HIV prevention interventions to service providers. These studies were randomized trials, not randomized trials of a risk reduction intervention, but rather trials of approaches that can be used to assist providers in using interventions that are being disseminated. The objective of our research was to determine what dissemination services most often result in providers adopting the intervention and using it as a part of their service program repertoire. We also sought to learn how providers tailored and adapted interventions to meet their local needs. Our first dissemination project was carried out in a collaboration with 74 AIDS service organizations representing most states in the country. All of the ASOs carried out HIV prevention programs for men who have sex with men and for women. The intervention being disseminated in the study was based on a small group cognitive behavioral risk reduction program, the kind of model that's been highly studied in the research field and is probably familiar to everyone here. In-person interviews with ASO directors measured the organization's baseline use of the intervention that included all of the core elements of the intervention being disseminated. Few of the organizations had offered the intervention at baseline. Agencies were then randomized to one of three dissemination conditions. A third of agencies received detailed assistance manuals, detailed facilitation manuals, intervention materials, and guides. Another third of the organizations received the same manuals, but also two-day on-site training that was undertaken and involved our staff from CARE, meeting with the organization's frontline staff, and spending 2 days in training and discussion about the model and how it could be used and tailored. The third group of AIDS organizations received manuals, the two-day training, but also ongoing telephone consultation, which were calls generally biweekly, in which a consultant discussed with the organization its goals, its problems, its successes implementing the intervention, advances towards implementation, tailoring the model to meet community needs, the organization's priorities and resource constraints, and a review of the intervention's core elements. 6 and 12 months following the dissemination activities, on-site interviews with AIDS organization directors were repeated, and adoption was considered to occur when the organization offered a client service program that incorporated the key core elements of the model that had been disseminated. We found that manuals only produced a modest increase in the percentage of organizations that offered the intervention, manuals and training a greater increase, and I'm sorry, there's an error in the last slide. What it should be showing is that the manuals initially, the AIDS organizations initially did not offer the intervention, but 75%, not 59, but 75% did at final follow-up. The implications of the study were that successful uptake of the disseminated intervention took place when providers had implementation guides, received intensive, interactive face-to-face training in the method, and also received individualized consultation concerning implementation efforts. A key component of the project was ongoing opportunities for bidirectional dialogue between providers and researchers. That seemed to be the key ingredient. Yet, while the outcomes were promising, this training model was time and cost intensive. There are, after all, thousands, in fact, many tens of thousands, of community-based providers doing HIV prevention work in the world. CARE research has shown that traditional technical assistance models carry considerable limitations for service providers. In an interview study with directors of 77 AIDS organizations from throughout the U.S., we found that organizations' predominant current programs for MSM were distributing AIDS education materials, giving AIDS 101 talks, and one-on-one educational outreach. Those were the majority of programs. Most programs offered to women were the same. When we talked with AIDS organization directors, they said we'd like to be able to offer more targeted, more intensive, individual, group, community-level programs of the kind that are studied in the research arena, but we have barriers. The main barriers were very high staff turnover. The majority of frontline staff held their job for less than 1 year in these organizations, lack of technical assistance, and limited budgets. Advanced communication technologies have the potential to link service providers nationally and globally with training, consultation, and experience sharing in new programs. The Internet is available nearly worldwide and can serve as a distance learning vehicle for providing interactive, practice-based training of service providers in new HIV prevention models. Distance-based training can be made available on demand whenever needed and as often as desired for new agency staff training or retraining, very relevant when there's high turnover in one staff. Apart from training curricula, distance models can link service providers and research consultants and also link agencies with one another for experience sharing. CARE undertook a project that was supported by NIMH to test whether distance communication technology could be used as a dissemination vehicle for international AIDS service providers. The project was called the Global AIDS Intervention Network, or GAIN Project. We identified 86 leading AIDS prevention NGOs in the capital or large cities of 78 countries in Africa, Eastern Europe, Central Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. We met with the directors of all of the organizations and solicited their input on the kind of prevention programs most needed, and they arrived at a consensus that community-level approaches would make the most sense. We selected for dissemination in this project the popular opinion leader, the POL intervention, because it appeared to us cross-culturally adaptable and suitable with multiple populations in multiple countries. Also, we know the intervention well. Each NGO director was interviewed at baseline to establish any use of the POL intervention or programs that included its core elements. The POL intervention includes 8 core elements, and the presence or absence of each element was measured in all of the community-level programs carried out by each NGO in the past 6 months. The 86 NGOs were then randomized within each world region to a distance training condition or to a lagged control condition. All NGOs received a computer, subsidized internet access, information about the POL intervention, and fact sheets about HIV prevention topics that were of interest to them. Directors and staff of experimental program NGOs received a distance dissemination program with 3 main components. Those were an electronic POL training curriculum, individual distance cultural consultation, and the encouragement of networking with other NGOs in the same condition. I'll talk more about each in just a minute. This project was technically complex because all communication, materials, curricula, consultation, and assessment measures were provided in the NGO's preferred language. So everything was conducted in parallel in English, French, Russian, and Spanish, which can reach a lot of the world. The POL electronic training condition, the curriculum, was used by NGO directors, managers, and frontline staff, either individually or in small groups at each agency. The curriculum was grouped into 3 modules, planning, carrying out, and evaluating and maintaining the intervention. Each module had many half-hour segments, so people wouldn't be stuck by a computer for a long time. The modules made use of instructional text and narration, video segments modeling critical intervention techniques, interactive problem solving, printable materials and manuals, and self-evaluation guides. NGO staff progressed at their own pace, could use either the curriculum on the computer or could print out the materials. Not everybody wants to spend all their time at a computer screen. The second component of the project was distance cultural consultation. Each NGO was linked throughout the project with a cultural consultant, who was a CARE-affiliated behavioral scientist experienced in implementing the intervention, an individual fluent in the NGO's language, importantly, an individual from the NGO's region or familiar with its cultures, and the consultants initiated and offered biweekly contact to the NGO by telephone, by email, or other modalities. The consultation focused on core elements of the POL model, tailoring and adapting the intervention to meet local needs, handling implementation problems, reinforcing the NGO's efforts, and assisting the NGO in any way possible. Organizations were at very different points. The consultation was client-centered. Some NGOs wanted to immediately implement the intervention, and we assisted them in doing it. Others were considering it and weighing it relative to other interventions, and we assisted them as well. Others sought our assistance in planning program funding applications to gain the money to be able to offer the intervention. The third component were NGO networking channels. Talking with researchers is not enough. NGOs in the distance condition were encouraged to share experiences, implementation issues, problems, solutions with one another through direct contact and via project website communications. The dialogue involved a lot involved locating funding sources, and NGOs shared approaches with target populations that included, depending on the NGO in the region, men who have sex with men, drug users, youth, students, factory workers, sex workers, unions of workers, and other groups. NGO use of the distance training program, we found that the curriculum was used by an average of 12 staff at each NGO. They viewed it for an average of about 7 hours, viewing 70% of its content. 93% of NGOs also printed out the materials and spent an average of 16 hours reading them. The mean number of consultations provided was 6 per NGO, with a range of up to 17. 72% of NGO directors rated the electronic curriculum as very useful, as did 88% for the print materials and 67% for consultation. 88% of NGOs held staff meetings about the intervention, 81% selected a target population in their community, and 57% wrote program funding applications. At 15-month follow-up, NGO directors in both the distance training and control conditions were re-interviewed concerning their community-level prevention programs carried out in the past 6 months. At follow-up, 43% of distance-trained NGOs, but only 17% of controls, had developed a new program based on the model. 64% of distance training NGOs had either developed a new program or often modified an existing program. Organizations in the training group more often incorporated core elements of the intervention in various of their programs. And we were heartened that 55% of organizations networked with other NGOs in their countries by sharing the electronic materials or conducting trainings for them themselves. Our conclusions were that advanced communication technology can bring on-demand training and consultation to service providers in a cost-effective manner. The number of agencies that can be reached is almost limitless. The distant methods that we use permit bidirectional communication and dialogue between researchers and service providers, as well as between service providers and others. And these approaches permit training access even to small agencies in regions far removed from other training. They create a more level playing field for access to training. There's a bigger picture. Traditional face-to-face methods are limited in their potential scale, scope, and number of people that can be reached. By contrast, we can envision virtual training centers that use advanced communication technologies to link aid service providers anywhere with flexible, on-demand, and whenever needed training and new program models. And we can envision this reaching literally around the world. This model is more than placing intervention manuals on a website. Whenever new interventions are shown efficacious and represent models that are sought by providers, interactive distance curricula can be developed. We can foresee an array of self-paced intervention curricula available to providers who could then pick the ones that most meet their needs. By doing this in multiple languages, one can reach the world. Our studies show that individualized cultural and behavioral science consultation are critical, as are opportunities for provider networking. Even with distance methods, the human touch is essential. I'd like to close with several observations. We know a great deal about the effects of HIV prevention interventions when studied in highly controlled, efficacious studies. As our last speaker pointed out, we need to learn much more about the effects of the same intervention when they're offered by providers in real-world settings to real-world clients and community populations. Interventions that are transferred from the research arena to service providers must be the kinds of interventions that are wanted by service providers. Much greater provider input is needed in the development of a research agenda in HIV prevention interventions. The means of providing training and technical assistance in carrying out evidence-based interventions must be accompanied by sufficient funding of providers to be able to implement them. And although we know a lot about the effects of many prevention interventions, there's a lot we don't know. Among our greatest priorities are interventions that can reach young ethnic minority men who have sex with men, reach persons with sexual and substance use intertwined risk, interventions for women with high-risk partners, interventions that promote long-term maintenance of change, not just initial enactment, and interventions oriented for persons with acute or primary HIV infection. The development of a repertoire of effective HIV risk reduction interventions is one of the greatest public health research achievements in the past 25 years, but these achievements can only contribute to the mission of stopping HIV and AIDS when interventions are placed in the hands of service providers, can be successfully used by providers, and bring about positive outcomes in the community. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Our last speaker is going to be Greg Millett. He is going to be speaking about HIV prevention, what works with young MSM of color. Greg Millett is known to many of you. He is a behavioral scientist at the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention, or DHAP, at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He is the lead scientist for Brothers y Hermanos, a large multi-site study investigating social and cultural factors associated with the high rates of HIV infection among Latino MSM and Black MSM. Mr. Millett is also the lead scientist on an exploratory study that employs respondent-driven sampling to target Black bisexual men. You've certainly seen Greg's work, I know, as he's published extensively, certainly in the American Journal of Public Health, the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, AIDS, Sex Transmitted Diseases, JADES, and many others. It is my pleasure to bring you Greg Millett.
Good morning. I'd like to thank the conference organizers for the opportunity to speak this morning. And I also wanted to express how much of a genuine pleasure it is to share the stage with such esteemed colleagues, as well as a pleasure it is to see as many people who are here today for the last presentation during the last plenary. I'm going to be discussing HIV prevention among MSM of color, what works. And briefly, just to give you an outline of my presentation, I'm going to talk about the impact of the epidemic among young MSM of color, some of the factors that are associated with disproportionate infection rates among young MSM of color, HIV prevention behavioral interventions, important issues for existing and future interventions, and then I'm going to give some conclusions and some of the next steps. So why focus on young MSM of color? Well, it's clear from the epidemiological data that YMSM are at greater risk for HIV infection. As much as 81% of new HIV/AIDS cases among male adolescents between 2001 and 2005 among MSM was among MSM relative to other members of other risk groups. And moreover, when you look at HIV/AIDS cases among adolescents and young adults in 2005 by race ethnicity, we find that young MSM of color, and particularly Black MSM, are a clear plurality of these cases, despite representing a minority of the U.S. population. The disproportionate burden of HIV/AIDS diagnoses among young MSM of color generally, and especially Black MSM, is also evident when we look at HIV/AIDS diagnoses by race, ethnicity, and age from 2001 through 2005. We see clearly, again here, that young Black MSM ages 13 to 24 are disproportionately represented among HIV/AIDS diagnoses. Now, some jurisdictions have reported an increase in HIV diagnoses among young MSM. Just a few months ago, the New York City Department of Health and Mental Health and Hygiene reported that new HIV diagnoses increased substantially among young MSM in New York City, while new HIV diagnoses declined by 22% among older MSM. In fact, young MSM now in New York City account for 44% of new HIV diagnoses. And when you look at it by race and ethnicity, we found that young Black MSM had an increase of about 38% in HIV diagnoses over that time period, while older Black MSM had a 23% decline. And you found the same thing among Latinos, the same pattern, that young Latinos had a 29% increase of HIV diagnoses over that time period, and older Latinos had about a 20% decline. And these data are data which I'm sure everyone in the room is readily acquainted with. This is from the Young Men Survey, which found a greater HIV prevalence among Black MSM, Latino MSM, and American Indian Native American MSM compared with white MSM, and comparable HIV prevalence between API MSM and white MSM. And another reason why it's so important to focus on young MSM is that when you take a look at the data by age cohort for Black MSM, you see that HIV prevalence actually triples from ages 15 to 22 to a median age of 32, where African American MSM are the hardest hit population in the Black community, where the HIV rates are just as bad as what you find in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, it is important that we understand what factors are and are not contributing to the disproportionate HIV rates among young MSM of color, because it has implications for HIV prevention interventions. We tend to define risk at the individual level, substance use, unprotected anal intercourse, number of sex partners. But we also need to consider interpersonal and social factors beyond the individual that influences HIV risk among young MSM of color. And the data bear this out. These are data from the Young Men Survey comparing substance use among Black MSM, Latino MSM, and White MSM. And you find here that young Black and Latino MSM are not engaging in greater risk behaviors compared with young White MSM. Consistently, young Black MSM are engaging in greater prevalence rates of substance use compared with Latino MSM or White MSM. And Latino MSM are engaging in less substance use risks compared with White MSM. And you find the same pattern when you take a look at sexual risk among young MSM as well. You get a clearer picture here between Black MSM and White MSM compared with Latino MSM and White MSM. But even though Black MSM were less likely to engage in sexual risk behavior compared with White MSM, they were still 9 times more likely in the YMS dataset to be HIV positive. And Latino MSM, even though they engage in less substance use behavior as well as some sexual risk compared with White MSM, they were still twice as likely to be HIV positive. And we don't only see this dynamic just in the YMS data. We find these paradoxical findings across studies from the very beginning of the epidemic. And in fact, my colleagues and I published a meta-analysis earlier this year where we compared HIV risk behaviors between Black and White MSM across studies and found that young Black MSM were 34% less likely than young White MSM to report engaging in any unprotected anal intercourse. And young Black MSM were also 75% less likely than young White MSM to report any substance use. We also find these paradoxical data when we compare API MSM with White MSM. This figure shows a percent of unprotected anal intercourse with two or more partners of unknown HIV serostatus among API MSM and White MSM in San Francisco between 1999 and 2002. And you see a steep increase in high-risk sex among API MSM, whereas risk increases and then decreases among White MSM. So perhaps looking at these data, one might expect an increase in HIV diagnoses among API MSM in successive years. Instead, we find that the number of HIV diagnoses among API MSM decreased slightly from 2002 through 2006 in San Francisco. Now, these paradoxical data can partially be explained by sexual networks and characteristics of sexual partners. The literature is replete with many articles that have looked at sex between older and younger adults and found, of course, that those younger adults who have sex with older partners are more likely to become infected with HIV. And we know also from the literature that Black MSM are more likely to have sex with older partners compared with other groups of MSM. And Kung-hee Choi has done some research where she found that API MSM were less likely to have sex with partners outside of their generation compared with other MSM. Another thing that we know is that interracial sexual mixing influences HIV exposure. And even though Black MSM and API MSM are more likely to report partners of the same race, because of background HIV prevalence is higher in Black communities, Black MSM are at greater risk for HIV infection than API MSM. There are also additional factors that influence HIV rates among MSM of color. Chief among them is unrecognized HIV infection. Again, looking at the YMS data, everybody in this room already knew that among those individuals who are HIV positive and African American, 91% did not realize that they were HIV positive. And among Latinos who are HIV positive in the YMS data, 69% did not realize that they were HIV positive. And this is important information because data shows that those individuals with unrecognized infection are the ones who are likely driving the epidemic in the United States. Another issue that's likely driving the high infection rates among MSM of color is ART use and adherence. We know from several different studies that young MSM of color are less likely to have access to ART. We don't have enough data on ART adherence, but just knowing that they have less access to ART, we realize that those men are likely to have a higher viral load, and if they have a higher viral load, they're more likely to transmit the virus to partners per act of unprotected anal intercourse. We also know from the data, too, that young MSM of color across the board have higher rates of STIs. And if you have a higher rate of STI in your community, you're more likely to become infected with HIV if you're negative and have an STI. And for those individuals who have an STI and they're HIV positive, they're more likely to have a higher viral load and to transmit HIV to their sexual partners. So what can we do? The good news is that behavioral interventions actually work. A recently published meta-analysis of HIV prevention behavioral interventions found that U.S.-based interventions for MSM reduced sexual risk by 35%. Moreover, individual, group, and community-level interventions targeting MSM all reduce HIV risk, with individual-level interventions reducing risk by 43%, group-level interventions reducing risk by 27%, and community-level interventions reducing risk by 35%. Moreover, interventions for young MSM reduce sexual risk by 29% in the meta-analysis. In addition, we have effective behavioral interventions for MSM of color. There's one behavioral intervention that only targeted MSM of color that we have in the compendium. It's a brief group counseling behavioral intervention for API MSM. There are also behavioral interventions that included substantive samples of MSM of color, like healthy relationships, which included a large sample of HIV-positive Black and Latino MSM, as well as the Empowerment Project that was undertaken with Latino MSM as well as white MSM in several cities. And we also have successfully adapted interventions for young MSM of color. A recent and exciting successful adaptation of an existing effective intervention was undertaken by Kenneth Jones and his team, CDC. Jones and his colleagues adapted the popular opinion leader model for young Black MSM. The adapted intervention is called D-UP, and the investigators measured intervention exposure in successive assessment waves and found that intervention exposure grew from 20% at the beginning of the project to slightly less than two-thirds of the surveyed individuals by the project's end, to slightly more than two-thirds of individuals at the project's end. And looking at the outcome for the D-UP intervention, the authors found a substantial decrease in rates of unprotected anal intercourse from the beginning of the project to the end. The intervention is currently being packaged by CDC and being prepared for dissemination. There are also other behavioral intervention research studies that are underway across HHS agencies. There are HIV prevention studies for MSM of color, like the Empowerment Project, which is being adapted for Black MSM, again being handled by Kenneth Jones at CDC. CDC has also funded several projects in the last year called LAMP, where they are developing new interventions for Black MSM as well as Latino MSM. There are four sites for Black MSM and two sites for Latino MSM. And one of the most exciting things that CDC is doing is an evaluation of Many Men, Many Voices. And why this is exciting is that this is one of the few interventions that came from the community that is rigorously being evaluated by CDC. There are also interventions that target HIV-positive MSM of color. As was mentioned in an earlier presentation, there is the ADAPT intervention where the goal is to reduce HIV risk behavior, and it's being undertaken in three communities using different models, popular opinion leader model, community response, and healthy relationships. And HRSA has also funded the Special Projects of National Significance Project, where they funded nine sites across the country to look at outreach, care, and prevention for young HIV-positive MSM of color, with the goals to increase care access and to reduce risk. So given all of that, there are still other important issues for existing and future interventions for young MSM of color. A recent paper reported findings of men who were grouped according to their ages when they first reported participating in particular milestones in the development of their gay identity. These milestones were when you first realized that you were attracted to a male, when you first had sex with a male, when you decided that you were gay, and when you told another person that you were gay. And the authors, after they categorized these individuals according to those who reported early, middle, and late gay-related development, found some fairly interesting results. Men who reported early gay-related development were more likely to report harassment for being gay during childhood and adolescence, and they were more likely to experience sexual abuse during childhood and adolescence. Moreover, the authors found that these patterns of risk continued into adulthood. Men who reported early gay-related development were more likely to report victimization as an adult for gay-related violence, more likely to be depressed as an adult, and more likely to be HIV positive as an adult compared to the other men. So bottom line, men who experienced discrimination and abuse related to their sexuality in childhood may be at greater risk for adverse consequences as adults. And how does this apply to young MSM of color? There are several studies that have been done with Latino MSM, Black MSM, as well as API MSM, which found the effects of discrimination certainly affect sexual risk in these populations. There are two studies that have been done with Latino MSM, the first one with HIV-positive MSM, and they found that the experience of discrimination was associated with greater rates of sexual risk. And, of course, most people in the room are acquainted with Rafael Diaz's work, where they found that homophobia, racism, poverty, psychological distress all explain 20% of the variance in sexual risk in their multivariate models. And with Black MSM, there was a recent publication that found history of discrimination was associated with greater sexual risk in Black MSM. And among API MSM, there's a paper by Yoshikawa that found that anti-immigrant discrimination experiences by API MSM was associated with increased risk of unprotected anal intercourse. I'd like to talk briefly about gay identity. Young men of color are less likely to identify as gay, and this is particularly Black and Latino gay men compared to other men of color. And non-gay identity, we all know from the literature, is associated with sex with women, exchange sex, drug use, but it's also associated with a lower likelihood of being tested for HIV. As important as it is to focus on men who are non-gay identified, when you still take a look at samples across studies, you find that most samples, even in gay men of color communities, most of these men still identify as gay, usually anywhere from 60 to 70% of the sample or more in gay men of color communities actually identify as gay. Now, why I'm harping on this point is that in the 80s and the 90s, gay identified men were less likely to engage in sex. However, that is really turned around. It's done a 180 over the last several years. And today, gay-identified men are more likely to engage in sexual risk behavior in terms of number of sex partners, unprotected anal intercourse, and more likely to be HIV-positive compared with non-gay-identified men. And I have to admit that one of the most dismaying things that I've noticed over the last several years is as a community, a public health community, we put as much focus onto non-gay-identified men when we still haven't finished our commitment to gay-identified men, where the locus of infections are. We need to recommit our efforts to target gay-identified men. Also, one thing that we need to keep in mind as well is that there are differences among MSM of color. These communities are not homogenous, and there's research that also supports this. Among Black MSM, in YMS, they found that those Black MSM who are of mixed race engaged in greater risk behaviors compared with Black MSM who reported that they didn't have mixed parentage. We also know that in studies of Black MSM that geography plays a role in terms of substance use, that Black MSM on the West Coast engage in different patterns of substance use compared to Black MSM on the East Coast. You also find these same patterns among API MSM. There are differences that have been found in the literature in unprotected anal intercourse with South Asian MSM engaging in greater rates of risk compared with East Asian MSM. And similarly to some of the data that I described a little earlier, mixed race Asian MSM also engaged in greater rates of unprotected anal intercourse in one paper compared to East Asian MSM. Among Latino MSM, there is one study that I found in the literature that found no differences among MSM in New York City between Colombians, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, and Mexicans. However, we do know that there are differences in HIV diagnoses among Latino MSM depending upon the country of birth. When this is a recent data from an MMWR showing, obviously, very different rates of diagnoses for MSM who are from Central America, from Cuba, from Mexico, and from Puerto Rico, as well as those Latino MSM who are born in the United States. And we also know, too, from the literature, a fairly clear pattern that emerges among Black MSM, Latino, and API MSM, is that those MSM who are born in the United States engage in greater rates of UAI compared with those MSM who don't. You find that pattern irrespective of race and ethnicity. So conclusions and next steps. First, behavioral interventions do work. And existing behavioral interventions can be adapted for MSM of color. Moreover, MSM of color are not a homogenous group, and we must tailor interventions to local needs and culturally specific needs. There are also new interventions for MSM of color underway, and community members and CBOs are meaningful partners in behavioral intervention research. The research cannot be unidirectional. We need to listen to our CBO partners and the community and able to come up with relevant as well as effective interventions for those communities. In terms of next steps, we need more research with API and Native American communities. I can't stand up here today and talk about why I'm a sum of color, but the implication in most of the slides and the data that I showed you are primarily Latino MSM and Black MSM. We need a clear focus with Native American MSM, and we also need a focus among API MSM. In addition, we need a mix of intervention strategies to impact the epidemic. Dr. Fenton and others have said several times during the meeting that when you take a look at the NHBS data, that only 20% of MSM reported ever being exposed to an intervention. And that just speaks to the fact that we need multiple types of interventions. We need network-based community interventions. We need community-based interventions, group-level interventions, as well as individual interventions. Not one strategy is going to buy us exactly the reduction in HIV prevalence that we need. We need to use all of them in tandem. We also need to use some of the traditional tools that we have in HIV prevention, such as HIV and STI testing and screening, especially given the large rate of unrecognized infection in these communities, as well as high rates of STI, as well as access to care for each of these communities. And last, we need more penetration from our interventions, and we need to put a clear focus on community-level interventions, network-based interventions, as well as structural interventions for each of these communities. And last, I wanted to acknowledge several colleagues who were instrumental in helping me design the presentation as well as giving me some data for the presentation. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking all of our panelists one last time. And now I'm going to be joined by my co-chairs, Dr. Kevin Fenton and Dr. Tim Mastro. While they're coming up to the stage and we're getting ready to say goodbye, I want to at least be able to express my thoughts, which I hope will echo yours on this meeting. I share Tim Flanagan's comments and many others in that I've been to a lot of these, but this is the first time in a long time I have felt like I can hitch up my boots and get out there and do it again. And I hope you feel the same way. It's been wonderfully refreshing to see so many people. I have truly enjoyed talking to so many of you. My only regret is I could not talk to each of you because I have learned so much from each of you. I spent every night sending 2- and 3-page emails back to the NIH about what we need to do, how we need to partner, because how different this meeting is from others where finally the lights have gone off for those of us who've been in the community and those of you who've been slogging forever in the community to say, you realize you need a partner in this. There is no one hero in this epidemic. And so with that, I'm going to close and say thank you and just say that, you know, Jesse has had that song going around in my head since he sang it on the plenary. But it must be catching whatever little spirit whispered in his ear. And as a person who is partially Native American, I'm hoping that perhaps my great-grandfather's spirit whispered in my ear because I woke up at 3 o'clock this morning, and the song that I had in my head was, "Ain't no stopping us now, we are on the move." And I hope that's true for all of us.
Well, Vicki, thanks very much. I have about 50 slides, but I think I can get through this in the next 40 minutes. But just to scare you a little bit. Seriously, it's thank you all for coming. The reflection is, why do we have conferences like this? Why do we bring 3,000 people to Atlanta, Georgia for 4 days to talk about HIV prevention? And then this last year I was discussing with an old friend and colleague that is not involved with public health of, you know, what I do for a living and why we have a meeting. And he goes, well, why do you have such a big conference in HIV prevention? It's not rocket science. And indeed, it's not. And it's actually, it's extraordinarily more complicated than rocket science. Rocket science is fairly straightforward. this simple virus with 9 genes that manages to get transmitted through sexual activity, substance abuse, sharing of blood products, has confounded us over the last 26 years, and we simply haven't quite figured it out. I think a conference like this helps us figure it out, and I think what we've realized over the last 4 days with, 420 oral presentations, 250 posters, dozens of roundtables, thousands if not millions of conversations, is we're still figuring it out. And since it is more complicated than rocket science, it's going to take all of us. So it takes epidemiologists to characterize the epidemic, researchers to refine what we do know and identify new ways to prevent transmission, all of you in the trenches at CBOs, NGOs, local health departments, state health departments, not yet, the federal level, that we all really need to pull together in this. We need policy. We need advocacy. It was great to see activism at this conference because we need to keep doing all this. I'm as energized as Vicky is. I think this conference will help move us forward. I'm ready to get on for the work tomorrow and going forward. So thank you all. We all need to work together on this, and thanks for coming to Atlanta.